We're going to continue today in our Abrahamic Covenant series. And we're actually up to part 13, believe it or not. Last time in part 12, we continued our study in the book of Hebrews in chapter 8. We got into the beginning of chapter 9. And we looked at the symbolism of the tabernacle, the priesthood, and their services. Today, what I want to do is I want to continue in Hebrews chapter 9 and begin by examining our long-deferred study of the symbolism of blood. Blood sounds like a very negative subject, but when we really get into it, it isn't. So just some of the parts of today's sermon are, you might want to shut the kids' ears or something like that, but this is all scriptural. Before we get into our chapter 9 mentions, I'd like to go all the way back to Hebrews chapter 2, please. Hebrews chapter 2. We've been through this before. This is in the book of Hebrews, this is the very beginnings of the blood symbolism and how it relates to the Abrahamic covenant and the new covenant. So, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. That's the core of the covenant, the new covenant. Jump down to verse 14. For as much then as the children of, that's of Jesus' Father, of course, God the Father, as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he, Jesus, also himself likewise took part of the same. Jesus took part of flesh and blood, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil. So we see that phrase there, flesh and blood. What is the connection between the two? What is the connection between flesh and blood? And why is blood so important to God? To find the answer, let's take a detour now. Please bookmark Hebrews 12 if you have a bookmark there, and turn to Genesis chapter 9, all the way back to the beginning here, where we find God talking to Noah after the flood. Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9. Verse 1. I'm going to read down to verse 6. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 1. And God, it's Elohim here, blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moves upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be meat or food for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things. Verse 4, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall you not eat. So God's people are not to eat meat that hasn't been properly bled. That's a standard thing that they do in the meat processing plants, hopefully. But God then warned Noah against the shedding of human blood. Verse 5, and surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of a man. Whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? For in the image of God made he man. Now, a few hundred years went by after that event, and the Lord God deemed it necessary to give a reminder, actually a treble reminder, of this law to Moses and the Israelites. Please turn over to Leviticus chapter 17. Leviticus chapter 17. Leviticus chapter 17 and verse 10. And whatever man there be of the house of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn among you, that eats any manner of blood, I will even set my face against that soul that eats blood, and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes an atonement for the soul. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, no soul of you shall eat blood, neither shall any stranger that sojourns among you eat blood. And whatsoever man there be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn among you, which hunts and catches any beast or fowl that may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof, and cover it with dust. For it is the life of all flesh, the blood of it is for the life thereof. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, you shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Whosoever eats it shall be cut off. God had Moses repeat these commands yet again towards the end of Moses' life. Let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 12, please. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 20. Deuteronomy 12:20. When the Eternal your God shall enlarge your border as he has promised you, and you shall say, I will eat flesh, because your soul longs to eat flesh, you may eat flesh whatsoever your soul lusts after. Jump down to verse 23. Only be sure that you eat not the blood, for the blood is the life, and you may not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it upon the earth as water. You shall not eat it, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, when you shall do that which is right in the sight of the Eternal. Verse 27. And you shall offer your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, upon the altar of the Eternal your God, and the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out upon the altar of the Eternal your God, and you shall eat the flesh. Observe and hear all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do that which is good and right in the sight of the Eternal your God. So, after all of those repeated warnings over and over again, what do our physical Israelite brethren do? Look in the encyclopedia and we find that they eat things like black pudding, a type of blood sausage, commonly eaten, it says, in Britain, Finland, Ireland, Sweden, and other modern Israelite countries. Blood sausage, black pudding. To make it worse, the encyclopedia also tells us that black pudding and some other blood sausages are generally made from pork blood, pig's blood. And to make it even worse, block your ears up, kids. Just after I left school, I worked for a couple of years in a meat importer's office in Liverpool. And the guys I worked in the office, so I didn't see a lot of this stuff, but the guys who worked in the abattoir, where they did the slaughtering and all of that, when they collected the blood from a newly slaughtered pig, well, actually, they got the pig, and they hung it up by its back legs, and they slit it down the middle. And when they did that, they burst its bladder, and the urine ran out with the blood. So, I know it's gross. I mean, the eating of the blood is a horrible thing. But when I found that out, you know, that was before I came in the church. But you know, that was it. You know. Anyway, let's try and push that out of our minds. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 2. But if you ever get the temptation to eat black pudding, remember that is a true story. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. I'm going to repeat this from before. For as much then as the children of the Father are partakers of flesh and blood, he, our elder brother Jesus, also himself likewise took part of the same, took part of the flesh and the blood, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil. Now, verse 15, and deliver them through the shedding of Jesus' blood, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Talking about deliverance there, it's talking about bondage. I'm sure that you'll remember the deliverance aspect of the Abrahamic covenant, which we talked about, and we also called it the Sarah covenant, when we compared the deliverance aspect of that to the bondage of the Sinai covenant, which we referred to as well as the Hagar covenant. Verse 16, for verily he, the human Jesus, took not on himself the spiritual nature of angels, took not on himself the nature of angels, which is a spiritual nature, but he took on himself the seed of Abraham, the physical seed of Abraham. Wherefore in all things it behoved him, what's this word, behoved? It means that it was effectively a debt for him. It was a debt, it was something that according to the terms of the new covenant agreement, he had to do. It was a debt for him. What was the debt? Carrying on in verse 17, to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. How did he do that? He did it through the shedding of his blood. And again, what we see there, this talking about him becoming a faithful high priest, a Melchizedek order high priest, and this making reconciliation for the sins of the people are all part of the core aspects of the new covenant and the grace aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. The core aspect, all of these things that the Sinai covenant sacrificial law could not fulfill. I want to see more of that as we go along. Verse 18, for in that he himself has suffered being tempted. Now the word, the Greek word there, can also mean proved or tried. He, Jesus, is able to succor, that means to aid or to help them that are tempted. So all of us are tempted, all of us are proved, all of us are being proved and tried. How did Jesus suffer? How was Jesus tempted, proved and tried? In many ways, but perhaps at the end of his life there, through the shedding of his blood, through these wounds that he suffered of the crown of thorns, the scourging, the crucifixion, and of course that final fatal spear thrust. Now let's go back to Hebrews 9, where we left off last time. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 7. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 7. But into the second, and he's talking about the second room of the tabernacle, the most holy place, or the holy of holies if you like. But into the second went the high priest, the Aaronic high priest, alone once every year. But it says, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. Now this not without blood, of course, means with blood, right? On the Day of Atonement every year, the Aaronic high priest went into the most holy place with the blood of a bullock and the blood of a goat, which had just been sacrificed and offered. The blood of the bullock was for the high priest himself and his family, and the blood of the goat was for the sins of the Israelite people. And again, we often read the details about all of that in Leviticus chapter 16 on the Day of Atonement. But going down to verse 12 here, still in Hebrews chapter 9, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, by Jesus' own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. Now you think about all of these Day of Atonement sacrifices year after year for, I don't know, 1400 or 1500 years. That's a lot of blood. And all of that, every sacrifice and every drop of blood is typical of the blood of Jesus Christ. It says so right here, by which he entered once into the most holy place, the real most holy place in heaven. But Jesus Christ, unlike the Aaronic high priest, who did have sin, who was human and did have sin, he had no need, Jesus had no need to offer for himself. He only had to offer for the sins of the people. He never sinned. But even though he never sinned, just the fact that he was on earth and he was among sinful mankind for 33 and a half years, he was somewhat, we use the word, besmirched by being amongst mankind, sinful mankind for that time. And of course, on that very last night there, he had all of the sin of the world laid on him. On the wave sheaf offering day, on the what we call the Sunday following Jesus' resurrection, he entered into not just the holy place, as it says in the scripture there, but the most holy place, and not the mere earthly copy of the most holy place that was in Herod's temple in Jerusalem, but the real one in his father's throne room in heaven. And this was the fulfillment of two different offerings. This was when he went back to God the Father on that day, on that wave sheaf offering day, that was a fulfillment of the wave sheaf offering, which was a cereal offering, okay? But it was also the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement offerings, which were blood offerings. The blood offerings of the goats and the calves, or the bullocks, which were commanded there in Leviticus chapter 16. Now the word there in Hebrews 9, there's a couple of words that are going to come up that are really interesting. We're going to look at them. The first one that's mentioned here is the word redemption. And that's interesting. Over the years in the church and studying the Bible, I've noticed that there's two R words, if you like, that are often associated with blood offerings. One is remission. We're going to come to that later. And the other one is this one, redemption. And what redemption is, in English, it's the noun form of the verb redeem. So you've got redemption and redeem, and they're associated words with each other. And in the Greek, the noun form is lutrosis, L-U-T-R-O-S-I-S, at Strong's 3085, and that stems from the verb lutruo, L-U-T-R-O-O, that's Strong's 3084. Both words, lutrosis and lutruo, they both mean deliverance, or more accurately, they mean release from bondage by the paying of a ransom, release from bondage. When I see the words redeem or redemption in the scriptures, I automatically mentally translate them to the idea of buying back, because that's exactly what redemption is. If you redeem something, if you put something in a pawn shop and they give you some money and then you go back and pay an exorbitant price to get it back, you're actually redeeming that item. Okay, so that's, in this case, that's exactly what has happened. All of us, every one of us, brethren, has been bought back. We've been redeemed. We've been bought back from Satan and this world of his, this world of Satan. The Apostle Paul, you don't have to turn this in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and 7, but the Apostle Paul wrote twice to the Corinthian brethren, you are bought with a price. And we've all been bought with, we've all been bought back, we've all been bought back with a price and with a ransom. And what was that price? What was that ransom? Well, we've already been told right here in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 12. But the Apostle Paul tells us even more specifically. You don't know, you can turn there if you want. It's Acts chapter 20 and verse 28. And the Apostle Paul says, the church of God, which he, Jesus, has purchased with his own blood. With his own blood. So that was the price. Jesus' blood was the price. Okay, we're still in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 13. For if the blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies to the purifying of the flesh. So what he's saying here, that this blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer, they provided a relatively inferior, partial, incomplete physical kind of sanctification and purification. But there in verse 14 we see what it's compared with in the new covenant. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? So in comparison with the Sinai covenant blood of bulls and goats, the blood of Jesus Christ, in comparison, this provides superior, full, complete spiritual purging and cleansing and sanctification and purification. And all of that gives us at one-ment with Jesus and with his Father. And those things enable us then to serve him. They bring us together with Jesus Christ and God the Father, which in the Old Testament the Jews never had to a full, complete extent. Okay. The word purge there, saying that the blood of Jesus Christ purged your conscience from dead works. And you've probably heard me say this before, because it's something that I constantly amazes me, the concept of blood being used as a spiritual cleansing agent. Again, it's an amazing concept, especially for you mothers. You know, that blood is one of the worst stains that a mum has to wash out of her kids' clothes. The very idea of blood being used as a spiritual cleansing agent, it just proves even more how God can make possible the impossible. Verse 15, and for this cause he, Jesus again, is the mediator of the New Testament. Okay, this is the New Testament, and the words are kainos for new, and diatheke, which you should be familiar with, for testament or new covenant, that by means of death for the redemption, it is again redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament. And this is protos diatheke, and that's talking about the Sinai covenant. They which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. So this promise of eternal inheritance alludes to the grace promises of the Abrahamic covenant and the new covenant. So it's telling us that the sins of all of us who have been called by God the Father, and even those sins which transgressed the Sinai covenant laws, they were redeemed, they were paid for by the death of Jesus, the terribly bloody death of Jesus, who was and is our mediator and redeemer. He's the one who God the Father uses to buy us back. Now, so we're going to have a rest from blood for a while. We're going to come back to it. And because right here in verse 16, the author of the book of Hebrews temporarily shifts gears from the subtopic of blood, and he gets into the interrelationship in the Greek language between the concept of the covenant and the testament, as in last will and testament, especially in the King James Version. I think in a lot of cases in the New King James, they convert it. Whenever you see testament, quite often they'll convert it over to covenant. But I think it's right that the King James Version stays with testament, and we'll see why as we go along, because it's the same word. Okay, diatheke, testament, covenant. Verse 16. For where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is of force after men are dead. Otherwise it is of no strength at all while the testator lives. So again, when the word diatheke is translated as testament, this makes good common sense, doesn't it? If we use the word covenant or agreement in this context, it doesn't carry the same logical weight as the word testament. In our minds, in our modern minds, we would not think that a mere agreement would ever necessitate a death to seal it. But considering the Sinai covenant and the new covenant as testaments, we know that deaths were necessary, bloody deaths were necessary. So we ask the question, what is a testator? We said that Jesus is the testator. What is a testator? A testator is a person, this is according to the dictionary, who has written or executed a last will and testament that is in effect at the time of his or her death. Now it's interesting, the Bible word diatheke, actually it's not, the Bible word for testator in English is a noun. But interestingly, the Bible Greek word is a verb, and the word is diatitheme, D-I-A-T-I-T-H-E-M-A-I, diatitheme, the Strong's 1303. And just as the English word testator is grammatically related to the word testament, it's the same in the Greek. Diatitheme is similar and related to the word diateke. Diatitheme is what it means. It means to arrange or dispose of a person's own affairs or of something that belongs to him or her. To dispose of by a will. Today we'd use the word bequeath. You know, if I wanted to give you all my worldly goods, I would bequeath them to you. And it can also mean to make a testament or a covenant. Great thing to do, make a will. Doesn't matter how old or young you are, make a will. It's a good thing to do. If you love your relatives, make a will. In the King James Version, as well as the word testator, this word diatitheme is translated into other words as well. Three times as the word make, and twice into the word appoint. Please bookmark Hebrews 9 and want to look at some of these alternate words for diatitheme. Jesus is the testator, and he used this word, but he didn't use the word. He didn't use the word testator. He used this word diatitheme. Luke chapter 22 and verse 29. We'll just hopscotch through a couple of them here. Luke chapter 22 and verse 29. And this is Jesus speaking here then. He's the testator. And he says, "And I appoint..." And that's the word right there, diatitheme. It's like he's saying, "I bequeath unto you a kingdom, as my Father has appointed," diatitheme, "as my Father has bequeathed unto me." So you see what he's saying there. And of course, that did not come into effect until after he died. Okay, let's go over to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. Just one verse here. Acts chapter 3 and verse 25. Acts 3:25. "You are the children of the prophets and of the covenant." And the word there is diateke, "which God made with..." And the word there is diatitheme, "which God made with, which God bequeathed to our fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in your seed shall all the kindreds of the earth be blessed." And right there, that ties it right in. This promise of God's blessing on the whole world through the seed of Abraham is the part of the promise of the Abrahamic covenant. Let's go back to Hebrews, still looking at these different English translations of the Greek diatitheme. So back to Hebrews and chapter 8, please. Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 10. And this the concept is virtually repeated almost word for word in Hebrews chapter 10 verse 16. But in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 10 he says, "For this is the covenant," okay, or testament if you like, "diateke, that I will make with," and the word there is diatitheme, "bequeath to, for this is the covenant or testament that I will bequeath to the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. Now, I'm sure you recognize what he was quoting there. This is part of the Hebrews author's quotation of the New Covenant prophecy from Jeremiah chapter 31 and verse 33. We don't have to go back there, but it says virtually exactly what Hebrews says there. But if we look at the actual Hebrew words in Jeremiah chapter 31, if we look at the word for covenant and make with in Jeremiah chapter 31, we would see that they are not grammatically similar to each other as they are in the English and the Greek language. But they're still very significant and worth looking at. The word for covenant or testament in the Hebrew is berith, B-E-R-I-Y-T-H. That's Strong's 1285. And the Hebrew term for make with is karath, K-A-R-A-T-H. We got the Karath is Strong's 3772, if you want to look it up. So grammatically the words are different. Berith, Karath, they don't sound the same. We actually did a couple of months ago, we did look at the word Berith, the Hebrew word for covenant, but let's take another peek at it because it is interesting and relative to what we're looking at here. Berith is a noun and it stems from a root verb, bara, B-A-R-A-H, and this bara can mean to eat, to consume, or to devour. And the Hebrew scholars tell us that this is especially relative to the idea of cutting. A more significant word, version of the word bara, is B-A-R-A apostrophe, and that can mean to create, to make, to shape, to form, to fashion, to cut down, and perhaps most significantly to cut out. Why is it most significant? It's significant because when this word berith is set in a sentence, as it is in Jeremiah 31:33, with the word karath, which is the Hebrew word for make with, the idea of cutting becomes even more clearly significant. Karath is as a verb, can mean to hew, H-E-W, to cut off, to cut down, and most specifically to cut a covenant. We probably, in our lingo today, in our slang, we talk about cutting a deal, you know. I used to think that was something to do with playing cards or something like that, but cutting a deal. Why is this cutting aspect significant, and why is it relevant to the blood aspect of the covenants? Doesn't take a lot of imagination to think about, to relate the two words, to think about bloody cuts or cuts causing blood or bleeding. We think about the bloody cuts, if you will, that Jesus suffered from the nails, from the spear, from the crown of thorns, and from that terrible flagellum, that whip that they used on him. All of them relative to his blood offering, his necessary blood offering for the New Testament and the New Covenant. That was for the New Covenant. Go back to the Sinai Covenant. Obviously much cutting was necessary for all of those millions of blood offerings that were necessary in those 1400 or 1500 years of the Sinai Covenant. We read earlier all of those animals had to be properly bled. But this idea of cutting a covenant goes all the way back to Abraham's sacrifice at the very inception of the Abrahamic covenant. Let's go back and read it again. Genesis chapter 15. You can bookmark Hebrews 9 if you want. Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 7. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 7. And he, this is the Lord, the Eternal, Yahweh, said unto Abraham, I am the Eternal that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees, or the Chaldees, to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Eternal God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he, the Eternal, said to Abraham, is what you do. Take me a heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and what did he do? He divided them in the midst. The Hebrew phrase there is bater tavek. And it means that Abraham cut the heifer and the goat and the ram right down the middle, right down their middles, if you will, and he actually separated them and put them close together. Was that bloody? You bet it was bloody when he did that. Still in verse 10, and laid each piece one against another, but the birds divided he not. And when the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. Verse 17, and it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, there appeared a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. So we know that they were definitely cut in pieces. In the same day, the Eternal made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto your seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. So right here we see a cutting and a blood sacrifice that were directly associated with the very beginnings of the Abrahamic covenant. When we look at all three, we see the absolute necessity for blood sacrifices in the cutting of all of these covenants, the Abrahamic, the Sinai, and the New Covenants, all required bloody cuttings. When we were kids, we used to say, bloody's in the Bible, bloody's in the book. If you don't believe me, go and have a look. Did you? Anyway, so let's go back to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9. And we're going to repeat verse 17. For a testament is of force after men are dead. Otherwise, it is of no strength at all while the testator lives. Whereupon neither the first testament, that's the Sinai one, when he says neither the first testament, saying not even the first testament, the Sinai testament or the Sinai covenant, was dedicated without blood. We know that, right? They had all of those millions of sacrifices, lots of blood. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, that's the Sinai covenant law, he took the blood of calves and of goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the testament, diatheke, which God has enjoined unto you. And that is a pretty bad translation, actually. All of this, that's quoted from Exodus chapter 24. Running out of time, so I don't want to go back and dig into it in a lot of detail, but The English and Greek translations of Exodus chapter 24 and verse 8 are not totally accurate. But what I want to tell you is that what Moses said was not, as it says here in Hebrews 9, "This is the blood of the testament which God has enjoined unto you." But rather, what he said was, "Behold the blood of the covenant or testament which the Eternal has made with you." And the Hebrew word that from Exodus chapter 24 verse 8 is the word karath, the one that we looked at before, and it means cut. So in effect, Moses actually said here, "Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord Yahweh cut with you." Okay, so still in Hebrews chapter 9 and still referring to Exodus chapter 24. Okay, Hebrews 9 verse 21, "Moreover, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry, and almost all things are by the law, the Sinai law, purged with blood, and without shedding of blood is no remission." And without shedding of blood is no remission. So again, no shedding of blood, no remission. No shedding of blood, no covenant, no testament, no deal. But there's that word remission. I mentioned earlier that there's two words that I frequently associate with the shedding of blood. One is redemption, and we looked at earlier, and this one, remission. In English, the word remission merely means reduction or decrease or lessening or diminution or cutback. But that interpretation of it is not enough. It's not all it is. Jesus' kind of remission, his remission of sins, is much more. And the Greek noun that is translated as remission here is aphesis, aphesis, is Strong's 859, and it's also translated in the New Testament as forgiveness, liberty, and deliverance. The extended Greek meanings are a little bit more revealing, and they include release from bondage or from imprisonment, forgiveness or pardon of sins, and letting go, letting sins go as if they'd never been committed. Now these extended meaning, they're getting a bit closer to the real intent of what's being said here in Hebrews 9. But I believe that there's even more to the word than these. And the implication here comes from the source verb. Most Greek nouns come from a verb. I don't know why, but that's true. The source verb for the noun aphesis is aphiemi, A-P-H-I-E-M-I, and that's Strong's 863. It means to send away, to yield up, to expire, or to send forth. It means to let be or let go, to keep no longer, or to give up. And if you think about those words, there's in those terms, there's an implication there of a forceful and even violent expulsion. And we can apply that expulsion to all of those sins. The word remission is often associated with blood. I said that before. And in this regard, in this relationship with blood, this would closely tie in with Jesus' violent, bloody death. If we think about the human circulatory system, and it can be thought of, if you're a plumber, if you know about plumbing, your human circulatory system is like a pipeline and pump system. Your heart is the pump, your arteries and veins are the pipes. not rocket science. I'm not saying that God didn't do a good job on it, he did, but it's a pump and a pipe system. Under normal circumstances, we all have a natural healthy level of blood pressure. I hope we all do. But as anyone who's witnessed a major injury knows, once a major hole or a cut is introduced into that circulatory system, then the blood exits the system with amazing speed and violence. Something we don't like thinking about, but when we think, usually prior to Passover, we think about Jesus' last night on earth as a human being, and we think on that historic Passover night that his formerly innocent blood was polluted, besmirched is the word that I used before, with all of the sins of the world, and they came suddenly on him on that last night. He went through the night carrying those sins, and in the late afternoon of that same Passover day, his sin-tainted blood, plus the, what they call the water and the gall, violently exited his circulatory system and went onto and into the soil and the rock of the place called Golgotha. And on, along with his blood, you see these old paintings of Jesus hanging on the cross with a little weep of blood coming from, usually from the middle of his hand, which was impossible, and a little cut in his side with a little bit of blood weeping out of it. I don't want to get into all of the details of it, but it wasn't that way. But the important thing is, when his blood exited his circulatory system, along with it went every sin that was ever committed by man in the past, in the present, and in the future.